Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Runner's World podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you the latest training advice, news and interviews from across the running world. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, tell us what we've got coming up this month.
Well, excellent episode this month. We've got Jasmine Paris, who will be talking about her incredible victory at last month's Spine Race. Phil Hewitt will be taking us through his new inspiring book, Outrunning the Demons. And we'll be looking ahead to the Boston Marathon with the help from our annoyingly fast CEO at Hurst, James Wildman, who's got a place.
There you go. Fair play. Fair play. What have you been up to this month, Ben?
The moment everyone hears this, they need to go to runnersworld.com/UK.
New website.
And it is smooth.
It is actually.
Yeah, it looks great, right?
It does look really good, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, so we've got a new website, so everyone go and have a look at that and find everything that you need to know about running. And on a personal level, Rick, I've been chasing mud.
Tell me more.
Well, because the Orion 15 is fast approaching, which is end of March, which is the next race for me. So everyone that I've spoken to, my good friend Nick Harris-Fry, who is an Orion Harriers man.
Okay.
He told me that it's notoriously muddy.
Right.
Because Epping is really muddy. I've been Hyde Park running in the sand.
Okay, like Red Rum.
Yes. And after the race, I will probably disappear.
Well, this sounds interesting, actually. Talking about mud, I went to the Southern Cross Country Championships in late January. That wasn't as muddy as previous years.
No, it's pretty dry on the heath.
It was all right, actually. Yeah. So it was a really good year of racing. Very, very quick. Great men's and women's fields. But there was a lot of chat about the run equal stuff. Because actually, at the Southerns, men and women run vastly different distances. So the men run 15K and the women only run 8. So it's almost like half the distance. Yeah. So there's a lot of run equal T-shirts out. And I know it's still getting a lot of debate in the running world. And
It's as far as debates go, though, it seems to be stuck in a loop.
Yes, agreed.
Right? So our first podcast, we had Maud on.
Yeah, a year ago.
Yeah, and she was talking to us then, and we were like, great, someone's raising this, and there's an official like drive and blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it just seems to be looping around and around with sort of surveys with runners, some saying they want it, some saying they don't.
Yes.
Similarly, the running clubs saying that they do and some saying they don't. And it just sort of... I don't know.
It's frustratingly slow.
And it seems to sort of got quite muddied and grey areaed in terms of like who wants what and things like that. But then
I think most runners welcome it, and I think also the general trend in outside running is towards equality in all things, isn't it?
Of course.
And that's what everyone should aim for. And I just think that actually the days of the Southerns being that big disparities between men and women are almost done, actually. I think two more years tops and we'll have equalised the distances, and I think that would be great. But we'd like to hear what you think, listeners. Have you got an opinion on this? We know it's a real divisive issue, so if you have, email us at podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Back in February 2016, Phil Hewitt was brutally robbed and stabbed during an attack in South Africa. While the physical wounds healed relatively quickly, the mental scars took far longer, and Phil found himself suffering from the symptoms of acute PTSD. Through running, Phil began the long road to recovery, and his new book, Outrunning the Demons, is a collection of real-life stories from other runners who have used running to help them recover from traumatic situations. Could you take us back, Phil, to that incident in February 2016? What are your memories of the moments kind of before and after the attack?
Well, it was such a strange day. It was a fantastic day in so many respects. I'd longed to go and watch England play cricket abroad. It was fulfilling an ambition, and it was a brilliant day. England lost, but surrounded by the wonderful South African families, so just taking the mick out of me that I travelled quite so far to see Joss Butler out first ball and Joe Root out for one, etc. And yeah, England lost, but I just left the ground on a total high. And I think I left my brains in the ground as well. I was looking around for a bus or a taxi to get back. It's about 6 or 7 miles outside central Cape Town. No buses, no taxis. I just thought, well, prolong the pleasure of the day and walk. And I asked a few people and they said, well, you can do it, but I wouldn't do it. But I just kept on going. And it's the Concord fallacy. The further into a project you go, the more difficult it becomes to go back. So yeah. I just kept walking and got to a point where the only way into central Cape Town was to walk along a motorway. So I was wandering along the hard shoulder and thinking, oh, my goodness, is this where my life ends?
Yeah.
And then the hard shoulder stopped and I scrambled up onto a bank and saw a little path on the far side of the motorway. So I legged it across 8 lanes of motorway, tumbled down this path, and I was in this wide open, desolate area, derelict area, and I could see central Cape Town on the horizon. I kind of knew where I was, but I didn't realise the implications of where I was. I was in a place called District 6, which is notoriously dangerous.
Right.
So I was just walking, striding through there, thinking, well, I know where I'm going, with my favourite Rolling Stones T-shirt on and a very expensive camera around my neck, and heard pitter-patter behind me. Someone ran up and said, I want your camera, or words to that effect, and seemed to punch me twice in the leg. And I think it was the force of the punch pushed me over. And in falling, I pulled him down and he was behind me, kicking me in the back of the neck, back of the head. And that was pretty painful. I just sort of tried to roll round. So he was in front of me, at which point he was kicking me in the stomach and kicking me in the throat, which was even more painful.
Yeah.
And when he was doing that, I looked down and saw that my leg was absolutely, totally awash with blood. And what I thought had been the two punches, he'd actually stabbed me. And so I let go of the camera. He got to his feet. And I think I'd really annoyed him at this point because he just stood there and kicked and kicked and kicked.
Wow.
So my stomach just kicked and kicked. And then he ran off, leaving me. I was sort of on rubbly, grassy bit. I sort of dragged myself up back onto the pavement. And I was just lying there thinking, what's going to happen? I was thinking all sorts of strange thoughts. You know, it's odd consolation. I was thinking, well, at least I've got my favourite Rolling Stones T-shirt on, being a Rolling Stones obsessive.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking that, I don't know, was time running out? There was a lot of blood. The blood was on the pavement around me. I could feel my eyesight going a bit wobbly around the edges.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was shock or blood loss, but I also felt this immense, overwhelming tiredness and just wanted to lie back and shut my eyes. But in the back of my mind, I realised that if I did that, then
that could be it.
I would have died, I think, because, I would possibly bled out, I don't know, but no one was stopped for what appeared to be a corpse by the roadside. So I propped myself up one elbow and wearing my GPS watch, I know just exactly how long I was propping myself up for, just under a couple of minutes, and this car pulled up, the only car around. So it was a horrible area, it was absolutely abandoned, desolate, it was bulldozed in the 1960s under apartheid, nothing there whatsoever, just rubble and flat desolation basically. Yeah. So I was so lucky that there was anything there, let alone the fact that this guy had the courage, the decency, just the brilliance to stop for me. And it was all slightly surreal. He was a pizza delivery driver, and he pulled up his pizza delivery car and started walking towards me, and he was pulling me up, and he pulled me into the back of his car, propped my leg up on this pile of pizzas. And I always think, you know, I need to apologise to anyone who received a home delivery pizza in Cape Town after about 8:30 that night, because it wasn't in a very nice state.
Right.
But just the things that stay in your mind, like the thing that goes around my mind is the fact, you know, how close was I? Was I sort of measuring in minutes at that point? Maybe I wasn't, maybe. But another thing that's really, I found shocking, was he had a lovely assistant with him who got out the car with him and walked towards me. I think she must have been about 16, 17 or so. And then she just stopped in horror and was staring at me. And I've never seen horror on anyone's face. And until you do, just the impact of it, she just could not speak. She could not move. Her jaw was dropped in horror.
Wow.
And just because she was looking at me. And for ages I thought, you know, I was really upset about that because I'd done that to her and I was hoping that she didn't have nightmares about it and I didn't want to be responsible for her upset. Mm. But then I think maybe about a year later, I realised why that impacted on me so much was because when I was looking at her, I was looking at the perfect reflection of my situation at that moment.
Right.
In her face was just, God, I must have looked a state. So the guy whisked me to hospital. He was brilliant. He started hitting loads of red lights and he's pulled up the car and yanked his pizza sign off the roof, gave it to me in the back, and then he whizzed through all the red lights, got to hospital, whizzed in, got a wheelchair, took me in, and I was stitched up. And yeah, it's quite a nasty tally of injuries. It's a very deep stab to my thigh and a gash that's about 4 or 5 inches to my calf and 3 ribs kicked in. And I think it's about 15 stitches, a couple of stitches in my hand as well. I must have tried to defend myself at one point. And pretty battered, bruised liver and very, very sore around the abdomen. And got back. Managed to get through the rest of the week in Cape Town and you sort of stagger on, not wanting to be the party pooper. I was meeting up with an old mate from work who was out there. And I think the shock of it didn't really hit me until I got back home. Mm. And then, blimey, it hits you with a vengeance. Sure. You just realise, you know, that moment could have been your last.
So was it when, upon return, is that when you realised perhaps that you hadn't quite gauged what had happened, or was it much further down the line?
I think you sort of continue with adrenaline, with shock, you just sort of carry on somehow, but as soon as back in the familiar environs of home, it just hit me, just what could have happened. And the thing that was so horrible and remains horrible was just so many unanswered questions. Mm. As a journalist, I'm used to asking questions, right, and I'm used to getting answers, and I just wanted to know so much. I wanted to know this guy's name, where he'd been, what he did with my camera, why he was in that situation, what he got for my camera. I wanted to know, you know, would I have died? I don't know that I would. What would have happened if the pizza guy had driven on by? And these questions just went round and round and round and round and round my head and just built up into a really horrible panic attack in a very quiet Sunday afternoon shopping centre in Fareham in Hampshire in Boots the Chemist. And I just stood there and just felt utterly overwhelmed. I didn't know whether I was going to faint, pass out, throw up, God knows what, or just collapse, or just whether I was even going to just run out of the shop screaming. But I knew if anyone had spoken to me, I would have dissolved into tears, God knows what. I would have been a total emotional meltdown. I just rode it for a couple of minutes that seemed like an eternity and just sort of came out the other side and thought, right, going back to see our local nurse the next morning. So I presented to him and said, he's a fantastic runner, 2:38 marathon runner. Impressive, seriously impressive. Times I would never touch. And I said to him, look, this happened. My wounds are clearly infected. And he looked at them and said, no, Phil, they're healing really nicely. Do you think you ought to talk to someone about this? And I didn't want to at that point. I have since, and it has been helpful, but I didn't want to at that point. So I came up with my own two-point plan that night. I started writing down everything that had happened, all the thoughts, all the emotions, all the fears, all the questions. I listed all the questions I wanted answers to. It was about 450 different questions in stupid degree of detail, the things I wanted to know about what happened to me. Started that, and that was a little bit of relief. And then the very next morning, with 2 stab wounds in my leg, 3 broken ribs on the other side, guts that hurt like hell from the kicking. It was about 2.5-3 weeks after the attack. I went for a run. And you guys will understand, as runners, bloody hell, something just lifted. And it was a lovely spring morning. And just suddenly I felt like I was me again. I was back. You know, no longer Phil had been stabbed, but Phil had run 30 marathons. And just something about it really, really hurt. But I could just feel the sort of mess in my mind starting to dissolve. I mean, it hasn't gone away. It never will. But that was the first thing that actually broke through the horror of what happened.
Did you feel kind of in control and kind of empowered again through running?
Absolutely, yeah. And chatting to our fantastic GP just before Christmas about trauma. And he was saying, in his understanding, the thing about trauma is the loss of control. And I think the most precious thing that running gives us, you get control back. You, even, you know, you decide what colour running top you're going to wear, which running shoes you're going to wear, and whether you turn left or you turn right, or how long you stay out for, how long you push yourself, whether you sort of chase it between the lampposts, whatever. You are suddenly back in control. And I'm sure that's what running gave me. And I think I think running also gave me a sort of renewed sense of connection. I think one of the horrible things about being traumatised is that you do feel isolated. You have this horrible, almost sort of arrogant feeling of no one can understand this, what happened to me. Most of us don't get stabbed.
Yeah. But
it's so difficult to convey to other people the feeling of, well, not the pain, but just all the sort of, I don't know, the vortex of emotions that go around your mind. You're in that situation, all the things you want to know about, and just loss of control, but isolation. But running just connects you, doesn't it? I'd never before then really understood the camaraderie of runners. I'd always been quite solitary as a runner.
Yeah.
But I started enjoying the company of runners in a way I never had before. But also, it connects you with nature. You're just sort of... I stopped listening to music at that point.
Yeah.
I'd always listened to music while running. And I didn't. And it was so lovely to just sort of be reconnecting with the outside world in a lovely sort of healing, positive, rhythmic kind of way.
Yeah.
You know what running does. I mean, it just gives you back a kind of sense of perspective, doesn't it? And sort of peace of mind, a sort of freedom and control. And running was giving me all those things. So I continued writing down.
Yeah.
And rather than an account of a trauma, the book, the text I was writing became an account of how running heals. And I continued to run, I continued to write, and it got to the point where it was starting to seem like a book, and that's when I sent it off.
Yeah. It's interesting, the book, because it's not just your story, Phil, which is incredible and worthy of a book in itself, and I think the way you talk about running is very, very moving.
You recognise the feelings.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as you say, not everyone will have experienced what you have experienced, but everyone knows that sense of connect when you're able to switch off from whatever it is that you need to detach from.
You don't have to be traumatised to enjoy running, but if you're traumatised, it certainly helps.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, even if it's just the sort of the stress of the day or the thing that's bothering you, can't perhaps get a grip on quite yet, but the run might help.
One of the interviewees in the book said running is the perfect mind tunnel, and that's what it gives you, isn't it? It's a way of putting things back into perspective and proportion. So when I proposed the book, Bloomsbury, the publishers, were fantastic. They've been absolutely brilliant throughout, so supportive, so constructive. Their instant response was, yes, they liked what I'd written, but they wanted a much wider survey of people who've run in the wake of awful things happening. To describe the book in a nutshell, it's essentially people who've been to hell and discovered that the quickest, surest, safest way back is to run. So I started researching, just looking on the internet, some people that I could try and track down and chat to. And I think I was enormously touched by the willingness and the openness and the honesty and the chattiness of all the people I approached, people who'd been through horrible things, but had gained something through running and were keen to share that. And I met with amazing openness, everyone I spoke to. So it's people who've run in the wake of 9/11.
Yeah.
There's a lovely story of a firefighter who perished on that day, which was actually his 40th birthday. And he was just 8 weeks away from running his first New York City marathon. And his widow just couldn't bear the thought of his number not crossing the line. It's the most powerful story ever. She wasn't remotely a runner, but just in that grief, in that trauma, in losing him on his 40th birthday, losing him whenever, she just became fixed on wanting his number to cross that line. So they got together, 13 mates of firefighting colleagues and former college colleagues, etc., and they stood 2 miles apart, 13 of them, on the route of the New York City Marathon. None of them runners, and just took his number from one to the next.
Wow.
And got his number over the line. And I just cannot think of a more powerful image of facing something that's absolutely insuperable, something that's just so unimaginably horrible, but you need to get beyond it. So what do? You just break it down, put it back together again, and that's what they did. And it's that kind of healing. I don't think, bizarrely regretted what happened to me, because I think you sort of pobble through life and then something comes along that makes you think, makes you stop, makes you take stock, makes you realise what really matters. what's important in life, and that did for me. And I think I have a greater appreciation of family and friends, and a greater appreciation of running, which I've always loved. But I kind of feel like I know why I love it now.
I was going to say, so you mentioned you'd run sort of 30 odd marathons prior to the anything happening.
The first marathon back after that was just the most extraordinary emotion. It's funny, something happened at work that really annoyed me, and I just think I couldn't run a marathon. Just out of annoyance at something at work, I just went out and ran 16 miles and thought, time for a marathon, so I did. And it just felt so lovely to be back at the start of a race in that great big huddle, all these people, all different backgrounds, all different reasons for being there. Yeah, and I think of all the 34 interviewees in the book, plus me, the 35th, as we're all running a marathon somehow. And some days you have a better day with the trauma, other days you won't. Sometimes you'll be 3 miles behind the front runner, whatever. Sometimes you'll start accelerating, but we're all on that same journey. All heading, it sounds horribly pretentious, doesn't it? But all heading to a degree of healing through running. Mm. And I think that's what running gives us. And that's what this book tries to celebrate, that running, it's absolute bliss if you've got the health to do it. It just gives you so much and it just keeps on giving. And I'm not going to run marathons as fast as I used to, but I'm still not convinced I've had the best out of running yet. The best is probably yet to come. And that is just through, I don't know, the solace, the comfort, the consolation, just the healing, the sheer healing, getting out there, being part of something and running.
Phil, thanks so much for telling us your story and talking about the book for the podcast. We've got an article coming out on your book later in this month, in this issue of Runner's World. I know the book's out in all good bookshops and online. So if any listeners that resonates with them, we'd fully encourage them to go out and buy it. And thank you again for coming on.
My pleasure. Really lovely to speak to you.
Hey, thanks very much. Thanks for the book is Outrunning the Demons, in case we haven't mentioned it.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Right, I wanted to bring something up, Rick, which we see come up. So it comes in cycles.
Yeah.
But why do people feel the need to dislike runners? And I bring this up because at the weekend, The Times published a sort of fluff piece titled Proof at Last That Running Really Isn't Good for You.
Right, yeah.
That was an opinion piece. And it's sort of the usual anti-running guff that sort of comes up. And I guess it's there to be read or not read. Like, that's totally down to the user and the individual. I'm just wonder why. Is it something to be controversial for controversy's sake, to gain a bit of internet chatter, to sort of position yourself? Why? Or do people genuinely dislike other people running?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you say, this stuff comes up about once a year. You get one of these sort of opinion pieces about running is bad for you. Running actually... They talk about stuff like chronic cardio. So this is the idea that actually going for these long runs isn't good for you and puts your heart in danger. What you ought to be doing, I'm not sure the piece talked about that, but you often get this argument that says what you should be doing actually is just sprinting or going or doing HIIT for like 2 minutes a day.
Yeah, okay.
And I just think actually it's these things are massive generalisations that almost are deliberately offering a kind of simplified version of the truth. And most of the evidence, Ben, as we know, is that running is actually rather good for you on lots of levels.
Yeah, well, I think that there's two things. I think I would be very concerned if someone who was having a very bad time was looking for an alternative way of making themselves better that wasn't prescribed medicines, wasn't something else, and someone referenced them to go for a run. Yeah. Like a GP might tell them to go do a park run, something like that. And all of a sudden they don't because they've read an opinion piece which is kind of nonsense.
Yeah, because it's powerful,
Because and then it gets shared around and people would see it and it'd be running is bad for you and, fake news, etc.
Mm.
I would hate to think that someone wouldn't try to something once that might make them feel better because they read something like that. So that's why it kind of it struck a chord with me. And I'm not just talking about, getting fast or being the best runner ever, but I'm talking about the benefits that we discuss regularly in running, the fact that it can really help settle you. And Phil, who talks to us on this podcast,
100%.
The healing power of it or the positivity that people gain from it, that sort of stuff that kind of irks me when...
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. Listening to Phil talk then, it's like the running's myriad benefits are not just about looking after your physical health bringing your heart rate down. It's got these great holistic benefits. And I think if people actually look and do a little bit of, even just a bit of Googling, they'll say the vast majority of evidence suggests that running is good for you. Everyone who's listening to this presumably is on board with that anyway. But I agree with you. I'm frustrated those pieces come out with a kind of this kind of depressing regularity.
And just a sort of like a sort of... I just sort of always, it kind of almost encroaches onto a world of where there's a resentment towards those who are running.
Mm.
And I don't get that either. Like, oh, look at that person being fit.
Yeah.
Idiot. Do you know what I mean? Like,
all, sure.
It's either an excuse for themselves to live their lifestyle in a way that they want, but not for someone else. I don't know.
I think you're right.
I'm probably extracting far more from it than I should.
No, but I think it happens with cycling. Well, I think any big movement where people are often slightly evangelical about stuff and are often telling you that it's great sets itself up to be attacked a bit, doesn't it?
So, of course.
So people want to take a pop shot at this stuff because for maybe in their mind they think that there's something kind of morally superior about being a road user.
Yeah, and you know, I'll play the other side of this as well.
Yeah.
Some runners are awful.
Yeah, I mean, and running isn't a magic bullet either, is it? And that's the other thing.
No, true.
So that it may be that kind of, sort of starts people off down this road.
Yeah, true. But I would hate... So basically what I think I would hate for anyone to not run upon reading something just on that opinion, because it might be the thing that really helps.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Last month, Jasmine Paris made headline news when she won the Spine Race. Not only did she win the 268-mile race outright, beating all the men and all the women, she also smashed the course record, and she did it all while expressing milk for her baby daughter en route. Jasmine, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Hello.
Now that the dust has settled, Jasmine, on your victory, do you get a sense of the kind of scale of what you achieved?
Well, I'm obviously really proud of what I did achieve, and I sort of felt that way when I finished the race as well. I think what's really been sort of quite eye-opening is the response that it's had in the media, and I wasn't really expecting that. So I feel like that's snowballed rather from. I guess what I expected maybe local news, and then it sort of became national news, and then it sort of spread across the world. So that certainly surprised me.
You're on BBC News. I think Barbara Streisand at one point tweeted about it. Have you been a bit kind of overwhelmed by the amount of interest?
The press stuff, because I'm just a fell runner, and I don't think this is like completely not. This is not typical at all for our kind of sport. All this usually we wouldn't, we wouldn't even get anything in the local newspaper type thing. So it's really, really a depart from the norm.
Yeah, it's not often that kind of fell running or mountain running makes the kind of national news, is it? It's almost kind of opposite of that. It's such a kind of humble kind of sport, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
On to the race itself. I mean, what were your expectations, Jasmine, going into it? Were you going for the overall win, or were you thinking about the course record?
So in terms of, I sort of started the race thinking that I could be competitive. Wanting to be competitive, but obviously it was a race unlike any that I've done before, so that meant that there was a lot of uncertainties in it. So whilst wanting to be competitive, I also, easily something could have happened that would have meant that I wouldn't have finished the race. I mean, it's a long way.
Yeah.
There's the whole sleep aspect. As we saw with Eugenie, there's things like hypothermia and other and sort of challenges like that that could easily mean that you didn't finish the race. So I felt that I could be competitive. And in terms of the record, I think that's so dependent on the conditions that I didn't really have any sort of plans with regards to that beforehand. I mean, I sort of drew up some splits, and if you were sort of guessing, I sort of naively guessed, oh, look, if you run at 4 miles an hour, you could still have, these good sleeps at these checkpoints and still break the record. I think it was a bit naive of me, though, to think that, because actually running at 4 miles an hour once you've been running for 268 miles is kind of, certainly for me it wasn't happening, maybe for someone else. So I think what I did in the end was sleep less. And run slower, and then I ended up actually finishing in around the time that I'd estimated based on those rough splits. But that was, it was a complete unknown, really. I was just guessing.
Because the race format is interesting, isn't it? Because you can essentially rest as much as you want. Is that kind of how that?
Yeah. So I mean, that sort of like begs the question, whether it's better to run it as a stage race, because that's kind of it sort of makes it exciting tactically. Because you could go out and sleep much longer at checkpoints and then try to run much faster between them. But, it's difficult running fast if you're carrying a pack.
Yeah.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
We're navigating. A lot of it's in the dark, and the underfoot conditions aren't great. Even if there's no snow, it's boggy. Those are all challenges to actually running fast across the ground. So you can't sleep too much because then you'd certainly would you know. Certainly would get behind.
How much sleep do you reckon you got in? Well, so it took you three days and a bit more than 3 days. How much sleep?
Yeah, so like 3 nights and I think sort of 4 days of running. Everybody keeps asking me. I'm pretty sure this is the answer. But obviously, I was sleep deprived at the time. So I think that I slept for less than 3 hours on the second night.
Okay.
And on the third night, I just had a doze for about 45 minutes. So probably I actually slept for around 3 hours in the entire race because on the first night I didn't sleep at all.
Wow.
So it wasn't very much. I had planned to sleep more than that. It wasn't in my intention to sleep as little as that. But at the last checkpoint, my competitor was about 2 hours behind me, and I really didn't want them to find me in the checkpoint. I felt that would be a big boost for them, so I wanted to get away before they arrived.
I mean, that sounds incredibly challenging anyway, but you also had the kind of additional challenge of expressing milk en route. How difficult was that? How much of a sort of distraction was that? Or in fact, did it kind of take your mind off at some of the other parts of the race?
Yeah, so I mean, it was sort of I hadn't planned that would be an issue. Would be something that I had to do. I was trying to wean my daughter in time. I just didn't manage it. So before, in the week leading up to the race, I was a bit anxious about that actually, just because it was sort of seemed another unknown. But actually, when it came to the race, it wasn't really such a big deal. The first checkpoint, it slowed me down a bit. So everybody was pretty efficient through there, and I left the checkpoint last. And I think that was really because I had to spend that extra time expressing milk. But the guys weren't that far ahead, and I caught them up fairly quickly. And after that, just people get less efficient at the checkpoints, and I actually was making less milk. So not unsurprisingly, I guess my body responded by sort of really sort of cutting the milk production. So it really wasn't such a big issue. And you're right, sort of maybe sort of having that kind of gave me something to focus on and worry about other things less.
Your victory's kind of started or maybe restarted a conversation about women bettering men at kind of ultra distance races.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that women do come into their own when the distances become longer?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I've even noticed that just in on a smaller scale, just doing I guess what we'd call a long fell race over sort of 20-25 miles.
Yeah.
And I feel like I feel like I can be more competitive with the men at those sorts of races.
Yeah.
The longer you go, the more competitive you are. And it's interesting as well. I think men tend to start faster and then slow down more as time goes on. Whereas
right,
I think
yeah.
women tend to come through the field in longer races.
Mm.
You'll often see the women start, if you look at the placings over checkpoints, they move up the field. So there must be something about the way that women run, whether, you know, whatever it is that gives them more stamina and it makes them better suited to run long distances.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true even in the marathon. I think there's quite a lot of data to support the idea that women are much more even pacers than men, who seem to get slightly excited and carried away at the start of the race. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've said that you're not planning on ever giving up your day job as a vet to kind of run full-time. Why is that, and what do you enjoy about maybe having a full-time job and also having a very impressive running career?
Yeah, so I think, I guess for me, running is ultimately a hobby. It's something that I do to unwind. Sometimes I think that actually the reason I seem to do quite well at it is because I enjoy it so much. And it's a kind of release for me. And in some ways, work and running kind of complement each other, because I do unwind by doing exercise. And it means that at work I tend to be more efficient, just because I want to get away to go running, and as well as obviously spend time with my family. So so ultimately, I think that I would like for it to remain a hobby and a joy. I think if I was to dedicate myself to it more seriously, then I might start to feel a little bit trapped by it. And in terms of a career, I'm not looking for a second career. I'm just looking for a way of having fun, really.
I'm interested in the kit that you were wearing, because I know it got down to kind of minus 20 wind chill factor, and it's fairly challenging underfoot conditions. What did you decide to wear on the Spine race?
So I'm an ambassador for Innovate. I get kit from them, which is fantastic, because I always wore their shoes anyway. So I was wearing Rock Lights with graphene enhanced soles. So the grip was pretty good, and about good on all surfaces, so good on wet rock as well. There's quite a few wet slabs on the Pennine Way and bog, obviously. But they're also comfy, so they're sort of like, it's a bit like sort of wearing comfy slippers for running, which is nice if you're running that sort of distance.
So I guess what would be less known by some people who've kind of just come to know you through the Spine race is that this is the kind of latest in a long line of very impressive runs. You've got records for the Bob Graham, the Ramsey Round. What's next, Jasmine? What's kind of your goal for 2019?
So one thing that I've not done before that I am doing this year is representing GB in the World Trail Ultra Championships, and that's in Portugal in June. So that, I'm quite excited about that. It's going to be a completely different sort of challenge. It's much shorter, I think about 45 kilometres, and it's going to be really hot. So I think the training is going to be really different. So I'm kind of like looking forward to the challenge of it. Yes, I always like to do something new and see how you can manage. So that's one thing. I'm running the Petit Trot à Lyon with my husband in the end of August. And that's a team race, and it's again a non-stop race. And that's around Mont Blanc. I think it's about 300 kilometres, and it's probably about twice the ascent there was on the Spine. So that'll be an interesting challenge. And then I've got some other challenges planned that are non-race sort of things that I won't talk about too much now, because I want to keep them under wraps.
Fair enough. I'm interested in what your running week looks like, because obviously you've got a fairly demanding job as a vet. How do you fit in running and the exercise?
Yeah, so I do all my, I think most, a lot of people with jobs that run would essentially train early in the morning. So I tend to train at 5 a.m. And that just means I get it done, and that it's a sort of protected time in the day. My husband and my daughter are still in bed, so I don't miss spending time with them. And so I get it done before work. And during the week, I usually run between an hour and a half a day. I don't run any more than that during the week, and then just because I don't have time. And then at weekends, I run, sort of up to 4 or 5 hours. But usually maybe 2 or 3 hours one day and 4 or 5 the next. And I do some cross training as well. I swim And mainly swimming, really, and hiking. We do lots of hiking with my daughter on our back, so that's good training as well.
Well, Jasmine, thank you very, very much for making the time to speak with us on the Runners World podcast. It's great to hear a bit more about your Spine Race victory, and we wish you all the best in 2019.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Bye.
This is the Runners World podcast.
I've got a question for you, Ben.
Yes.
What's the most badass thing that you've ever done during a run? Because very recently there was a runner out in Colorado who literally choked out a mountain lion with his bare hands.
He did. It was a juvenile.
The mountain lion.
not the man.
Yeah.
Even more dramatic. A juvenile. Yeah, it was a juvenile mountain lion.
Right.
I don't think it takes away from his achievement.
No.
But still, I mean, I feel, again, like, I feel bad for the lion.
He's just
roaming around doing lion stuff.
But I think it's basically a kind of fight for survival at that point. Yeah, the guy didn't go out. He wasn't, like, hunting.
No, very different. But, you know, you do feel...
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm really glad that we run... Well, like, a slightly hostile badger is the worst.
That's worse to get. But still, I was kind of like, wow, that's really...
Shit.
Well, kind of amazing that someone was able to do that, but you didn't answer my question anyway. What was the most badass thing you've ever done?
Well, I was just delaying because I genuinely don't think I chased off a squirrel.
In a slightly less heroic subject, we're doing the London Loop Relay in May. So, this is this 150 mile loop of London. We've got a great team assembled, and I've done a little bit of recce in Bent, and I have to tell you that, if you don't study the map incredibly quickly, getting lost is almost an inevitability.
All right. Well, that's good. I mean, that makes the 24-hour time challenge slightly more...
It's a navigational challenge.
Yeah. All right, good.
So we need to get people out there. On the plus side, no mountain lions.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Okay, now, everyone, we must behave. For we have the boss here.
Absolutely.
God, don't behave on my account, please.
James Wildman is the CEO of Hurst UK, and this means he's a very busy man. But recently, he has discovered a joy for running, completing his first marathon at London last year, and is now storming through his majors with a PR in New York in November that earned him a place at Boston. Welcome to the Runners World podcast, James.
Thank you, gentlemen. Very, very great pleasure to be here.
I think before we talk about Boston and your current state of running, we wanted to just ask you about were you a child runner?
My personal journey.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, actually, I wasn't. Until very recently, I had never run, is the truth. I worked in my previous job at Trinity Mirror, and they sponsored the Great North Run. And I had no intention of running that, having never run in my life before. And this is about 3 years ago. And my mates, about 2 months before the run, said, by the way, we're not doing it unless you run it too. So with that sort of blackmail, I had no choice but to sort of get my head down and start pounding the mean streets of Walling where I live, and turned out I could run. So I did the half marathon without stopping. I did a reasonably good time. In fact, my mates were gobsmacked because I beat all of them.
What time are we talking here, Jay?
I did 1:35
off
the bat. So with some training, I mean, obviously I'd done some training, but not a huge amount, to be honest. And so with that in mind, I arrived at Hurst in sort of April 2017, and I think between Andy Dixon and Alan Williams, obviously the editor-in-chief and the MD of our wonderful brand, Runner's World, they were sort of chatting about bucket lists and things. And I said, well, I would obviously, having done a half marathon, I would love to do a marathon at some point in my life, but I'm sure I'm not capable. I'll be honest. I turned it round on them and said, look, I don't think I'm capable of doing this, but because I hadn't even run a step since the half marathon I'd done 2 years earlier. So I said, it's up to you to get me round.
Right.
And Andy, I will remember this very vividly, probably the most demoralising conversation I've ever had in my life was Andy. And I think I'm going to say this. This is exactly what he said. He said, the trouble is, James, you're kind of, I've mind my language, haven't I? But you're going to struggle. Let's put it that way, because you're an old guy, right? I mean, I'm 52 now. I was 51 then, and you know, having never run a marathon or ever run seriously, you're going to either break yourself, become injured through the training for the marathon, if you do the training required, or if you don't do the training required, you'll never finish it. So I thought, well, that's probably the most disappointing conversation I've ever had.
Cheers, Andy.
Great pep talk.
Exactly. It was an interesting way for him to resign, I thought. So he said, so he rose to the challenge brilliantly, and he set me the Runner's World training schedule to run your first marathon, which I started on the 2nd of January. He gave me the first off to recover from my hangover from New Year's Eve.
And, that's generous.
And I started pounding the streets. And, you know, I had the beast from the east to contend with, so a lot of my training was necessarily on a treadmill inside, which was boring. But I didn't do it religiously, but I stuck to it reasonably, I would say. I didn't change my diet. I didn't stop drinking booze, which I quite like occasionally. Yeah. Got myself into a place where I was reasonably fit for the first time in 3 decades, I would say.
Yeah.
Enjoying my running, you know, just getting into the, you know, really loving it more than I thought I would.
Yeah.
And I ran the London Marathon.
You make all this sound quite easy, James, and quite casual. How do you fit running into like a packed day?
I don't typically. What I was doing was running at the weekends. Mm-hmm. So I was carving out time from my family time, and I was doing a run typically on a Saturday, as short as sort of 5 miler, and then slowly week by week building up my Sunday run over the time. And then maybe 2, maybe maximum 3 times a week, I'd just after work go on a treadmill in the local gym. But I was having to sort of just find time, do as best I could. Just made it happen, really.
I heard that you did some pretty long treadmill runs, like 3 hours on a treadmill.
I think that might be a slight exaggeration, but I definitely did a very long one. I got through a few podcasts that day. I discovered Mickey Flanagan. Not Mickey Flanagan?
Yeah, comedian.
Yes, who actually helped me enormously on a couple of those runs.
Yeah, all right, good. Yeah. I think that a lot of people will relate to this sort of idea of picking up running later on in life, either for for many, many different reasons, not just necessarily like a bucket list challenge, but sort of like regaining fitness from an injury or
midlife crisis probably comes into it somewhere.
But why did you want to do it? I mean, you said a bucket list, but sort of like, was that literally just it, or was there sort of an over?
Well, I'll be honest. I mean, it's a privilege to do the job I do, and working with a brand like Runner's World, it gave me a wonderful excuse, didn't it? I mean, you know, I want to lean into the brands that I work with, and I want to support in any way I can, really. So I thought, well, that's quite a nice way for me personally, a very selfish way, perhaps, of getting involved with what a good proportion of my team do. So that was great, really. In the back of your mind, I think people. I've always been one to set myself challenges. I quite like pushing myself. And my dad had become ill, and I thought, I've never really done anything for charity. Yeah. So that was another motivation for me. And I was humbled with the support. I mean, I think I raised almost £13,000at the London Marathon. I had something like 250 people sponsored me. So that was really, extraordinarily humbling. So, I found the whole experience absolutely brilliant. I mean, inspiring in more ways than I can tell you. I mean, it was very moving. It was extraordinary. I had a fabulous sense of achievement afterwards.
Was that a surprise for you, how much you enjoyed running? Were you expecting to enjoy that? Yeah.
No, I wasn't expecting to enjoy it. And I thought I'd probably get something out of the fact that I was getting, as you say, getting a bit fitter. But I found it, I think both in terms of my mental state, because as you say, we're all busy and we all work hard and there's a lot going on. It's quite a frenetic life, I think, that we have. And, in work, given the complexity of what we're doing and the changes around us, it's busy, right? So actually finding time for myself, which I've never really done before, and just going off and, losing myself a bit, either listening to music, discovering, as we said, new comedians or just taking in the sights and just breathing. Yeah. I mean, I've absolutely loved that more than I thought. So I would say it's as much mental as it is physical for me.
Yeah, we hear that a lot in the mag. A lot of people kind of go to running for the mental benefits almost first before the physical. Yeah.
Yeah. And also I'm lucky, right? Because it turns out that either my genetics or there's something I'm fortunate. I have a reasonably good engine.
Yeah.
Because it turns out I can just run a bit Forrest Gump-like without knowing it beforehand. But I've got I went to see a trainer because my knee started hurting. And he said, you've actually got a very good sort of engine. So my cardio is strong, but my mechanics are starting to fail right now. So I've just got to be a little bit careful about pounding too much concrete.
We'll have you doing some kettlebell swings before you
Good luck with that.
So London was great. You enjoyed it very much.
Loved it. So, yeah, I saw parts of London I've never seen before.
So then you immediately signed up for New York?
No. I thought that would be the only marathon I'd ever run. Right. And given that our headquarters is in New York and I had reasons to be there serendipitously that very week for business, I kind of convinced myself that it would be a good idea to do another one. Yeah. So there I was in New York with my trainers and my shorts. And
great.
I was able to run the New York Marathon. So I did that. And it's funny, Alan and Andy said to me beforehand, you'll never beat your London time, which was 3:32. Anyway, it turns out I did. So I got my head down and did 3:19 is my new PR.
3:19 in New York is very fast. Like that's.
I didn't feel it was, but I was.
So that leads to the.
It's a lot quicker than 3:32 as well. So you wonder what you
half
might
a minute a mile quicker.
Yeah.
So sub 3 at Boston?
No chance. No. Well, interestingly, it's funny because you know these wonderful apps you get now, because it was slightly different in New York to London, but both were brilliant. And what New York had on their app, which London didn't, was an age-adjusted time.
Right.
So my 3:19, I'm not sure how the algorithm works or how they work this out, but my 3:19 age-adjusted, according to their algorithm, was 2:53. I sort of convinced myself that had I started running in my prime of life, before I discovered booze and all the rest of it, then I might have beaten 3 hours.
Do you now? Do you have a retrospective slight like, oh, if only I'd, or is it just
not really? Man. I don't really have too many regrets, but I do think some. I do wonder whether if I had been if I'd taken it seriously as a younger man, maybe I would have been half a decent runner.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
Give Mo Farah a run for his money.
Did you see the conditions in Boston last year? Because they weren't good, James. It was snowing, sleeting. It felt like -5.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a beautiful spring day.
Well, Boston, you never know, apparently. So it can be really, really hot, or it can be absolutely freezing.
See, that's not good to hear.
So it's just something to bear.
Just take a jacket. Would be the only
right. I'm going to have a rustle through your store cupboard.
Oh, it's going to be great. I'm doubly jealous of this because I once ran a Boston time, and it coincided with a period where I was between jobs for 2 months. And I'd spent this period just running. I was on the North Downs, actually.
Whereabouts on the North Downs? Because I'm on the North Downs.
So I was running a lot from kind of Guildford to Box Hill, and then Box Hill to Caterham. So, yeah. So
well, I'm just above Caterham, where I live.
Okay, right. So absolutely love that part of the world. And I was like, oh, I'm going to Boston. And then I looked at the flights, and I'd just left it a little bit too long. And I also hadn't been working for a month, so I just felt like my wife wasn't really going to be loving the news that I was about to kind of pay for this flight to Boston. But by this point, I'd got in, and I was like, right, I need to make a responsible decision here. So I actually decided to run Milton Keynes instead of Boston. But I got the grids, basically. So it was quite a come down. Like, I got the mail through the post that says, you'll get this. It says, Boston bound, and I was like, I'm not Boston bound anymore.
Oh, how depressing.
Milton Keynes. But I tell you what, Milton Keynes Marathon, much more scenic than you think.
Well, I'm committed now. It's a few weeks away yet, and I've got to start training properly, but I booked my flights.
Good.
So I'm now I'm psychologically committed. Yes.
Oh, that's great. That sounds good.
So, I mean, have you, from London through New York to now Boston, how is your training looking? Is it very structured again, or is it?
I think I've probably slipped a bit each time, if I'm honest. I did it religiously ahead of London because I was a little bit scared. I was really worried about my, you know, just the ability to get round, and mainly because Andy got in my head and said I wouldn't. I mean, it was the way he looked me up and down and just shook his head. And so it was just so demoralising. But
I think he's judged you perfectly.
Exactly right. He knew the psychology. He absolutely did. So I sort of did do that reasonably religiously and found London, because London, I don't know if you remember, but London was really, really hot.
Yeah,
last
we both
year.
Ran
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You did both run it. You were pacers, weren't you? So and it was like a tandoori oven hot. The road was melting, smell of tarmac, and people collapsing all over the place. I remember that very vividly. And I thought, I got round that without stopping. And, you know, so a little bit of me thought, oh, actually, this is quite easy. You know, I can do this relatively. So I think maybe psychology for New York, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, I've done a marathon now. I know what to expect. And I did it in the heat of London. It won't be that bad. So, I didn't train quite as hard. And I'm not going to train quite as hard again for Boston because my knees are starting to hurt a bit and I don't want to break myself and, you know, be in pain and not be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, you alluded to the fact earlier in the interview, James, that you're not the youngest of runners is something that you came to.
All right.
not rubbing it in.
There's no room for ageism anymore.
Absolutely. But what advice would you give to a runner maybe in their 40s or 50s who hasn't run but is thinking about taking it up and is maybe a bit intimidated?
Yeah. Just do it. I mean, it's easy to become a little bit intimidated, I think it's fair to say, because it is a bit scary because you worry about, you know, breaking. I mean, but I would say, and I guess everybody's experience is going to be completely different, so, you know, but I found it extraordinarily helpful, actually. I didn't realise that I didn't feel I needed the help or, you know, had a, you know, something missing in my life, but I've found it really, really helpful, and I would recommend it to anybody. I think for you don't need any preparation. You just put on some trainers and a pair of shorts and off you go. You know, you don't need equipment, you don't need to plan it, you don't, you know, it's great.
It's incredibly simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do your family make of your running?
I think, do you know what, they think I'm a bit mad, a bit bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, when I head off in the pouring rain sometimes and, you know, they know I don't want to because I've, you know, had a late night the night before or,
yeah,
you know, but but I think they've always thought I'm a bit odd like that. Do you know what, they were really proud of the fact that I ran the London Marathon for my dad and that, you know, achieved something that was very special for me. So there's a certain amount of pride, I think, and I'm chuffed to bits with that.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a bit, you know, I've lost some weight. I'll be honest. I didn't go out to lose weight, but I haven't changed my diet at all, but I'm in a much better shape than I was.
Yeah.
So that's good. And I think they probably appreciate that. I think I might live a little longer as a result. I hope they is something they'd like.
Are you slowly are you converting them as runners?
No, I would never do that. No, I don't think it's. And my son actually, you know what? My son and I were going to run the London Marathon together last year because we were both lucky enough to have places. But he injured himself training.
Right.
It was the arrogance of youth, if I'm honest. So he's 23. He decided that he didn't need to worry about training schedules and ignored all your great advice, unlike me. And then subsequently found himself with a bad knee, you know, 4 weeks out.
Well, these young people.
Yeah. Well, there is a bit of that. And I think, you know, he just thought, oh, how hard can it be? I'm fit. I play hockey, you know. And I don't want to do him down because he's a wonderful chap. But, so he didn't run. So he deferred his place for this year. And now I think he's a little bit disappointed I got my Boston place because it means I can't run London with him because it's only 2 weeks after. So he's planning to run
London. He's also got the pressure of beating his dad's time.
Yeah, well, he believes that's a walk in the park. I mean, he doesn't. I mean, he's 100% convinced.
Well, we can see where he's inherited his sense of, like, achievement from.
Oh, he reckons he'll just turn up and run sub 3 hours. He's actually said, if I'm not sub 3:10, I'll be gutted. That's it. I mean, that's his...
Fair play.
Yeah. That's good. Maybe like ambition.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
Natural ability. You can't question natural ability.
I think he might be confusing ambition with ability, but we'll see.
Where's your favourite place to run, James? Do you like running sort of in...
I love running where I live.
North Downs, yeah.
Yeah. I don't love it in the gym so much, but I kind of get myself into a space with where I zone out and it's okay.
Yeah.
But where I live in a place called Wallingham, which is on the North Downs, slightly further east from where you were running.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous track because there's a, you know, you can go off-road.
Mm.
I don't tend to do that, but I should perhaps more. There's a run along the ridge, which is along the North Downs, with a really lovely view south. So I've got a sort of a 10-mile loop, which is quite a nice...
Yeah, it's quite hilly around there as well, isn't it?
There are a few hills, which is why I think New York was relatively easy, because everyone said it's going to be really, really hilly.
Yeah.
But I think if you're used to running on hills a little bit,
I
didn't even notice the hills in New York.
Yeah. Are you close to... Is it Botley Hill? Is that really close to you?
Botley Hill. So Botley Farm... Is the pub you're thinking of, which is at the top of Titsy Hill.
That's it,
which comes up from Oxted. That is the corner of my 10-mile run.
Oh, right, okay.
So I run past Botley Farm.
Highest point inside the M25.
Well, that's good knowledge.
Do you think that running, though, is now part of your life, so that you'll carry on running even if you don't?
I think I will. I'm not sure I'll run marathons.
Yeah.
I am honestly a little bit worried about the knees. Not in a desperate way, but I just...
You've got to be careful.
I'd like to be able to continue to run a bit and do tennis and play sport until I'm much older. And I don't want to sort of end up with, you know, sore knees or operations and stuff, like a lot of my friends are. So, you know, but I think I'll always... I enjoy it.
Well, James, thanks so much for coming on the Run As Well
podcast. Thank you for having me.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Run the World podcast. I want to say a huge thank you to our guests, Jasmine Paris, Phil Hewitt and James Wildman, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
For more from Runner's World, why not visit our website, runnersworld.com/UK, where you'll find more news, reviews and interviews from across the running world.
If you'd like what you've heard, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. It's also on Spotify and most Android apps. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.